join the general envelopment of trapped Soviet armies. What doomed Case Blue was not just the stubbornness of the Stalingrad defense. First was the foolhardiness of Hitler's dividing the limited forces of Army Group South roughly in half, as if Germans by 1942 had the resources all at once to take the city, cut the Volga River, and capture and exploit the oil of the Caucasus before reaching the Caspian Sea. Expanding and thinning the front while battle still raged along a now 1,500-mile Russian axis, as well as in North Africa, and over the skies of Germany itself, would prove strategic lunacy. Second, that error of splitting German forces was compounded by fighting for weeks amid the rubble of Stalingrad, when for all practical purposes the aims of General Paulus's Sixth Army had already largely been met. Much of the traffic on the Volga had been disrupted, and Stalingrad was rendered mostly uninhabitable and unproductive. Paulus could have redirected his army southward to rejoin Army Group South or to have established a defensive shoulder well before it was encircled. Hitler's orders to take Stalingrad at all costs seem to have contradicted his original strategic objectives to finally destroy the active fighting strength remaining to the Soviets and to take away as far as possible their most important resources of war. That required the Wehrmacht to unite all available forces in the southern sector with the objective of annihilating the enemy forward of the Don, and then gain the oil fields in the Caucasus region and the passage over the Caucasus itself. By late 1942, Hitler finally had begun to worry about America's involvement in the Allied cause and was eager to make additional American logistical capability irrelevant in the way the German high command had tried in early 1918. Hitler sought to gain the resources of the Soviet Union, knock it out of the war, and hold a defensive line along the Volga before the industry of the United States revived both Britain and Russia. Joseph Goebbels noted in his diary on March 20, 1942, on the eve of the Case Blue offensive, that Hitler is determined under all circumstances to end the campaign at the beginning of next October and to go into winter quarters early. He intends possibly to construct a gigantic line of defense and to let the Eastern campaign rest there. Our position toward what remains of Russia would then be like that of England toward India. Goebbels apparently failed to note that Britain for centuries had governed the huge population of India with a modest constabulary, in part because of clever statecraft of the sort that would have disgusted the Nazis. Stalingrad, however, soon became emblematic of the conditions that had previously stalled all German armies in the East. For a second time, the Wehrmacht, berthed in a wintry climate, did not prepare well for the Russian cold. German generals complained constantly of the poor Russian roads, even as their plans hinged on relying on the worst of them in the south. When German armies ground to a halt, Hitler, a captive of maps, intervened directly, ordering impossible offensives and no retreats, while diverting tens of thousands of soldiers in sudden new directions, without any knowledge of the living hell that his soldiers faced. He seemed to think that the nightmare of winter 1941 was long over, its lessons learned and never to be repeated, especially far to the south of Moscow. The besiegers of Stalingrad soon became the besieged in late November. Two huge Soviet pincers, dubbed the Stalingrad and Don fronts, targeted the Sixth Army's northern and southern flanks, which were poorly guarded by the ill-equipped subordinate Romanian Third and Fourth Armies. The ensuing Operation Uranus was a vast Soviet effort to spring the trap far to the German rear, near the city of Kalach. Unlike the earlier and incomplete German efforts of the Sixth Army to cut off Stalingrad at the Volga River, the Russian ring soon formed a 360-degree encirclement. The Sixth Army became separated from its supplies and was soon pulverized by massive artillery barrages in sub-zero weather that made reliable air support impossible. Equally important, Hungarian, Italian, and Romanian Allied forces along the Don River were threatened, collapsed, and suffered catastrophic losses that were to lead to political repercussions back home. The Sixth Army was surrounded from November 23, 1942, to its final surrender on February 2, 1943. The combination of cold, hunger, and disease, typhus most prominently, proved as lethal as the Russians. If the Sixth Army was one of Hitler's premier armies, its workmanlike administrator, Friedrich Paulus, was not one of Hitler's more imaginative field generals. In fact, by any definition, Paulus was not a field general at all. He was a respected staff officer who had never held a major battle command in his life. By summer 1942, those far more gifted had either been killed, captured, fired, forcibly sent into retirement, bought off, or were stationed far from the strategic nexus of the war. Paulus perhaps combined the worst two traits for dealing with a mercurial Hitler. He whined in private about Hitler's erratic behavior, yet he took no action to nullify it and salvage his army. In the manner, for example, of General Paul von Kleist, commander of Army Group A, who would ignore Hitler's orders, save the surrounded German Eighth Army in March 1944, and thereby would be relieved, or of General Erwin Jönicke, who would be dismissed and put on trial for refusing to sacrifice the trapped 17th Army in the Crimea. Paulus was not liked by his staff, and was later blamed by his officers for failing to use the brief window of possible escape from the pocket. The Soviet commander at Stalingrad, General Vasily Chukov, was a brawler who bivouacked with his men. While Paulus lamented that his once mobile divisions were mired in a rat's war, Rattenkrieg, General Georgi Zhukov, the ultimate architect of the Soviet counteroffensive, stood up to Stalin to ensure his plans for Operation Uranus were carried out as he envisioned. In terms of imagination and daring, Operation Uranus, conceived in haste and desperation, was far more logical an operation than the complex and carefully planned Case Blue. Hitler's greedy authorship of multiple agendas in trademark fashion had ensured that a huge army either could have taken Stalingrad and cut off the Kiev-Volga supply route, or could have reached the Caspian Sea and deprived Stalin of much of his oil. But it could not quite do both. By attempting both, it could do neither. In terms of Hitlerian nihilism, it would have made far more sense in September to focus on bombing the Soviet oil hubs of Grozny and Baku than to keep hitting the rubble of Stalingrad. Even without accurate intelligence about the Soviet buildup, General Paulus had at least warned Hitler of such a nightmare scenario as early as September, as his own siege of the city stalled and the Sixth Army supply lines lengthened. Hitler was so close to winning a key siege that in his exuberance he completely forgot that the Sixth Army was soon to be outnumbered by the defenders and without reliable supplies with winter approaching. Most of his generals seem to have lacked all historical perspective that a failed siege often meant not the withdrawal but the ruin of the attacker. By late December 1942, efforts of General Erich von Manstein's Army Group Don, Operation Winter Storm, to reach the entrapped Sixth Army ended. His failure was due to Hitler's continued interference in day-to-day operations, as well as bad weather that hampered air supplies. The inexperienced Paulus also did not initiate a simultaneous breakout from his entrapment. And even the highly regarded fireman Manstein apparently did not grasp the difficulty of advancing to Stalingrad at a time of growing Russian strength. Either Paulus feared to act independently of Hitler's edicts, or he was too paralyzed in depression over his own self-induced predicament. Like most forlorn German generals, he blamed the Luftwaffe. "What should I say, as supreme commander of an army, when a man comes to me begging, 'Herr Generaloberst, a crust of bread?' Why did the Luftwaffe say that it could carry out the supply mission? Who is the man responsible for mentioning the possibility? If someone had told me that it was not possible, I would not have reproached the Luftwaffe. I would have broken out." But it was hardly difficult for a German general to doubt Hermann Göring's ludicrous bombast that he could supply the Sixth Army completely by air, even given bad weather, Soviet air defenses, and too few planes. Hitler may have talked grandly of Stalingrad as a Festung, but in fact, as one veteran put it, one could not speak of a fortification anywhere. The term Fortress Stalingrad must have sounded like pure irony, if not bloody sarcasm, to the encircled troops. On February 2, 1943, between 90 and 100,000 near-starving besieged besiegers surrendered, all that was left of Germany's once grand 300,000-man Sixth Army. Thousands of stragglers were found amid the ruins for weeks thereafter, and Soviet and German record-keeping in any case was not always complete. The few left who went into Soviet captivity were famished and cold, many were sick, and nearly 9 out of 10 soon died. All but 6,000 German prisoners perished in Russian camps. The survivors were only returned to Germany in September 1955, following an embassy from West German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer. Aside from those who surrendered, Stalingrad had cost the Axis coalition another 150,000 to 200,000 dead and missing, including tens of thousands of lost Hungarians, Italians, and Romanians. When the failed Case Blue offensive essentially ended in November 1942, Army Group South's various divisions of Group A had, in addition, suffered yet another 300,000 casualties. The Soviets, as customary before 1944, suffered even greater losses, perhaps all told over 1 million killed, wounded, missing, or taken prisoner. In terms of disasters, fewer surviving Germans surrendered at Stalingrad than would give up within 6 months in Tunisia, perhaps over 230,000 Italians and Germans to the British and Americans. Moreover, the surrender of the survivors at Stalingrad per se was not comparable to the horrendous encirclements that the Soviets suffered in 1941, such as the Kiev Cauldron, 665,000 Russians captured, or the Vyazma and Bryansk pockets, 650,000. Immediately prior to Stalingrad, the Soviets in July and August alone had lost another 600,000 prisoners, 7,000 tanks, and 6,000 artillery pieces to the encirclements of Army Group South. Yet the unique melodramatics of Stalingrad made it far worse than all prior or subsequent mass surrenders on the Eastern Front, and in fact the worst military moment in Germany's history. Unlike Stalin, who was on the defensive while forming massive new armies, Hitler was waging an offensive without reserves. All that could be said for Case Blue was that the strategic aims were so ambitious that even Stalin, who as a Marxist-Leninist materialist supposedly would have anticipated an offensive to steal resources and end the Soviet means of production, was initially surprised that the 1942 offensive had not targeted either Moscow or Leningrad. In the context of historic German defeats, the German disaster at Stalingrad was reminiscent of, but far worse than, Napoleon's rout of the Prussians at the Battle of Jena-Auerstedt in 1806. Before Stalingrad, the German army had stalled, but had not suffered outright defeat. After Stalingrad, it never conducted a clear-cut, sustainable offensive campaign again. As Joachim Wieder, a survivor of the battle, put it, drifting through the snowstorm, this was the wreck of Sixth Army that had advanced to the Volga during the summer, so confident of victory. Men from all over Germany, doomed to destruction in a far-off land, mutely enduring their suffering, tottered in pitiful droves through the murderous eastern winter. They were the same soldiers who had formerly marched through large parts of Europe as proud conquerors. Before Stalingrad, German morale had recovered from the disaster of late autumn 1941, when Blitzkrieg had stalled at Leningrad and Moscow. After February 1943, however, survival, not victory, was the only hope on the Eastern Front. Stalingrad entered the realm of the surreal, a distant Soviet outpost some 1,600 miles by land from Berlin, little known to the public back home, where a huge German army had not been just mauled or been forced to retreat or suffered terrible casualties, but had simply been swallowed whole. The captured General Paulus and other high officers offered the Soviets a propaganda coup and were soon to broadcast defeatist warnings on Soviet radio. Even the Soviets could not initially grasp the magnitude of their destruction of the Sixth Army. Yet the Red Army after Stalingrad eventually earned a reputation for invincibility that lasted for most of the war. "You cannot stop an army which had done Stalingrad," became a common Russian refrain. In contrast, for the German veterans of Stalingrad, the defeat became accepted as the turning point of the war. When the second year of the Russian offensive began in spring 1942, Hitler had faced a reckoning. His armies had suffered enormous losses in 1941, over 1.1 million casualties, with 35% of the original army that entered Russia in June 1941 now gone. Such attrition was not fully replaced by mid-1942. German forces were now 500,000 men fewer in number than the force that began Operation Barbarossa. In the first 6 months of Barbarossa, the Germans only added 100,000 troops to the army on the Eastern Front. The Soviets, in contrast, increased their military by well over 3 million. The German army at times was capable of killing Red Army soldiers at unimaginable rates of 7 or 8, but not 30 to 1. By early 1943, much of the Germans' cobbled-together motor transport had been destroyed or worn out, and the majority of its horses were dead, at a time when the Allies were beginning to rush shipments of thousands of trucks to motorize the Red Army. The once backwater Italian effort in North Africa had grown into an open German sore that siphoned off vital resources from Russia to the Africa Corps, in a doomed effort to prevent the loss of North Africa. As the disaster of Stalingrad ended, Soviet munitions production increased, even as diversions of German air power from the Eastern Front spiked to protect the homeland. Yet while the 6th Army stalled to the north at Stalingrad, an orphaned Army Group B of some 50 divisions, led by General Maximilian von Weiss, reached the Volga. Its twin, Army Group A, under Field Marshal Wilhelm List, got close to Grozny, some of its soldiers on August 21, 1942, climbing Mount Elbrus, the highest peak in the Caucasus. By October 1942, the Luftwaffe was sporadically bombing some of the oil fields around Grozny, a strategy that, had it begun earlier, might have done far more damage to Soviet oil production. The subordinate effort at Stalingrad doomed all that effort. In sum, Blitzkrieg, dying at Stalingrad in 1942, would soon be entombed in 1943. Both Goering and Propaganda Minister Joseph Goebbels, in their post-surrender broadcasts, tried immediately to invoke history's glorious last stands to romanticize the catastrophe, as if Stalingrad, as an official Nazi communique put it, was one of the most treasured possessions in German history. General Manstein's invocation of the last stand of the Spartan defenders at the Pass of Thermopylae in 480 BC was pathetic and mendacious, as if the Sixth Army was battling for freedom and consensual government on its home ground, rather than for national socialism abroad. But in the end, the proper classical allusion is Thucydidean. Indeed, Stalingrad proved to be Germany's fatal wound in the manner of the Athenian Empire's disastrous defeat in far-off Sicily, 415 BC, so famously summed up in the Peloponnesian War. At once most glorious to the victors and most calamitous to the conquered, they were beaten at all points and altogether. All that they suffered was great. They were destroyed, as the saying is, with a total destruction. Their fleet, their army, everything was destroyed, and few out of many returned home. The fortified eastern Libyan harbor of Tobruk changed hands four times during the war. Before 1940 and after 1943, the port was little known and of no real strategic importance, as it is a backwater today for the occasional visitor to war-torn Libya. But for a brief 2.5 years, Tobruk became renowned as the center of fierce Allied Axis fighting along the Libyan-Egyptian border. The Italians initially surrendered Tobruk to the British on January 22, 1940. The British and Dominion forces then held it heroically against attacks, as the port served as a key British base of operations for 17 months until June 21, 1942, when a German and Italian army under Colonel General Erwin Rommel stormed the city. But just 5 months after Rommel's feat, the Germans themselves abandoned Tobruk on November 12, 1942, as Rommel's forces fled westward in hasty retreat after their defeat at the Second Battle of El Alamein. Tobruk's value was that it was almost exactly halfway in the vast 650-mile, mostly empty seaside expanse between the British port of Alexandria to the east and the Italian harbor at Benghazi to the west. Each side saw its alternating possession of Tobruk as proof that it had reached a point halfway to its destination, whether British held Alexandria or Axis occupied Benghazi. Along the huge Libyan and Egyptian coastal battlefront, it offered the only developed harbor where sizable ships could unload. For the Axis, Tobruk was also at the end of a near-perfect north-south vertical line across the Mediterranean, from German-held Athens through Crete to North Africa. Nothing much had changed from antiquity when Tobruk was known as Antipyrgus, directly opposite from Pergus, the key ancient Greek port in southern Crete. For the British as well, Tobruk marked an equally straight but quite different latitudinal supply route from Alexandria to Malta. The war in a desolate eastern North Africa hinged on supplying fuel, food, and ammunition along these two antithetical lines, given that there was little support to be had from either indigenous towns or the desert. After the Germans' capture of Tobruk on June 21, 1942, one of the last great victories of the Axis, Rommel dreamed of using the port and its captured stocks to supply his smaller army in a re-energized race eastward. For a brief moment in midsummer 1942, Germany saw second-chance glimpses of grand victory. The old fantasy of grabbing the British naval base at Alexandria, Egypt, and cutting off entirely the British in Cairo, now seemed to seduce the Germans. From there, Rommel thought that he might even storm the Suez Canal and cut off Britain from its direct routes to its Middle East oil supplies. And Rommel dreamed even more grandly that his tiny Africa Corps then could continue eastward to join a victorious army group south descending from the Black Sea and the Caucasus. If the German armies met in the oil-rich Middle East, then both Russia and Britain would be denied almost all their Persian Gulf or Caspian Sea oil. Or so Rommel imagined after his brilliant capture of Tobruk with its ample supplies, without much serious reckoning that his wild dreams were largely dependent on the continuous captures of such Allied stocks, while the Allies assumed that they could replace far more than they lost. The initial Italian surrender at Tobruk in 1940 and the final British recapture of the port in November 1942 are today little remembered. Even the heroic British and Commonwealth resistance to Rommel's early failed efforts to storm the port is often forgotten. Instead, Tobruk is most famous for its second fall, the dramatic but rapid surrender to a returning Rommel on June 21, 1942. The British collapse riveted the world, largely because the unthinkable suddenly had become the inevitable. Despite the odds and problems of supply, Rommel, in late May 1942, had risked another battle against the defensive line extending south from Gazala, west of Tobruk, on the Mediterranean coast, to draw out the British Eighth Army under General Neil Ritchie. Rommel maneuvered his army next to enemy minefields, dubbed the Cauldron. With his flank protected, he waited for Ritchie's counterattack, and then blew apart most of the British armor with the Africa Corps' veteran anti-tank gun batteries. The beaten British backed off from their fortified Gazala line. After the Luftwaffe and artillery had blasted a hole in Tobruk's defenses, Rommel poked right through and captured the port on June 21st from the bewildered South African general Hendrik Klopper. The effect of Rommel's sudden victory was stunning. Churchill was in Washington planning grand strategy with his new wartime American ally, only to be humiliated by the shock of Tobruk. The disaster was too reminiscent of the disgrace of the fall of Singapore, February 15, 1942, in sharp contrast to the grim and ultimately successful resistance of the civilians and soldiers of a defiant Russian Leningrad, even as they suffered hundreds of thousands of deaths. The news would cause Churchill to return home to a motion of censure from Parliament. Although the resolution was easily defeated, the debate was a sign of popular outrage that once again a sizable Commonwealth force had quit rather than fight to the death. Until the fall of Tobruk, the Allies had dreamed that the tide of war might be already turning. The Battle of Midway, June 4th through the 6th, 1942, had checked the advance of the Japanese fleet. The Germans had split their forces and the northern contingents were nearing Stalingrad, but were meeting stiff resistance from the Red Army. The Italians and the Germans had failed in their first assault on Tobruk and had retreated back to El Agila. Rommel should not have been able to take the city. Although he commanded about 80,000 German and Italian troops, total respective British and Axis forces in the theater were about equal at around 120,000 men. The British also had nearly twice as many tanks and armored vehicles and over 200 more aircraft, and the Luftwaffe was insidiously losing air superiority. While most of Rommel's supplies and reinforcements were running low, Tobruk was stocked full of food, fuel, and ammunition. By mid-1942, supporting naval gunfire along the coast was more often British than Italian. Malta still held out. The British had received new American Grant medium tanks with 75mm guns that were superior to any of Rommel's early model panzers. The Americans promised much more, and there was already talk of a late-autumn Anglo-American landing to the west in Algeria and Morocco. All that said, the British remained in awe of Rommel and often praised him as a splendid military gambler. Churchill gushed, "We have a very daring and skillful opponent against us, and may I say across the havoc of war, a great general." The Africa Corps fought with an elan lacking among the defenders of Tobruk, and it did not help the British cause that their various Dominion troops often served under commanders who were not their own. Churchill was not shy of what might follow Tobruk in his bleak assessment to the House of Commons. Rommel has advanced nearly 400 miles through the desert and is now approaching the fertile delta of the Nile. The evil effects of these events in Turkey, in Spain, in France, and in French North Africa cannot yet be measured. We are at this moment in the presence of a recession of our hopes and prospects in the Middle East and in the Mediterranean, unequaled since the fall of France. If there are any would-be profiteers of disaster who feel able to paint the picture in darker colors, they are certainly at liberty to do so. A painful feature of this melancholy scene was its suddenness. Yet in terms of casualties or strategic ramifications, the fall of Tobruk was hardly like the sieges of Leningrad or Stalingrad. There were few civilians in the city, and almost none were either British or German. Collateral damage was limited. More important, Rommel failed in North Africa even after his capture of Tobruk. The effects of the port's capture were instead again psychological. The heroic and successful resistance in 1941 and 1942 was merely a prelude to tragedy. Tobruk also raised the specter that the disaster at Singapore 5 months earlier might not have been a fluke, but symptomatic of a British or indeed Western democratic propensity to give up rather than fight on. That Tobruk also shortly followed the American surrender at Corregidor on May 6, 1942, shook the entire alliance. These worries about innate British and American equivocation would vanish a little more than 4 months later, 350 miles to the east in Egypt at the Second Battle of El Alamein. There the British Army, far better equipped and under newly assigned General Bernard Montgomery, stopped an ill-supplied Rommel for good. The Gafrica Corps had taken their key port at Tobruk, but the victory won little more than a cratered harbor without ships and just enough supplies to reach El Alamein and defeat. Unlike Tobruk, the formidable Soviet naval base at the tip of the Crimean Peninsula at Sevastopol may have been the most impressive fortified citadel in the world by the outbreak of World War II. The stronghold, made famous during the 19th century Crimean War, had once taken the British, French, and Turks a year to storm it despite the Allies' unquestioned naval superiority on the Black Sea and well before its 20th century massive concrete and steel fortifications. Sevastopol was protected by the Soviet Black Sea Fleet, not large by blue water standards and often poorly maintained, but preeminent within the confines of a quasi-inland sea. Even if the paltry Axis naval forces had controlled the Black Sea approaches, it was nearly impossible to stage amphibious landings. Steep cliffs bristling with casements loomed above the harbor. Unlike at Singapore and Corregidor, the large-caliber artillery batteries of Sevastopol easily could be aimed out to sea as well as inland. The permanent arsenal was beefed up with over 400 mobile artillery pieces and still more mortars and anti-aircraft guns. The landward routes of attack were mined, fortified with artillery and bunkers, and bordered by dense forests and uneven terrain. The Soviet Independent Coastal Army under Major General Ivan Petrov had over 100,000 Soviet troops burrowed into the fortifications. The besieging Axis forces of General Erich von Manstein, given the preparations for the impending dual offensives aimed at the Volga and the Caspian Sea, enjoyed only a 2-to-1 numerical superiority over the entrenched defenders. Manstein was under pressure to take the city quickly and join the German drive to the south. Yet Manstein's numerical edge was due only to the presence of Romanian allies under Major General Gheorghe Manelu. Time was on the side of the defenders, and it was not clear in a strategic sense whether the fortress was even worth the cost of taking it. An exasperated army group south had wisely considered bypassing Sevastopol in the initial invasion of the Soviet Union in 1941, after attempting and then failing to surprise and storm the base. By November, Sevastopol was cut off by land. For the next 8 months, it remained isolated, except for occasional supply by sea. The city posed no threat to the German advance, except for a few Soviet bombers that the Germans feared might disrupt the planned assault on the Caucasus oil fields to the east. Even as Army Group North remained static far to the north at Leningrad, Hitler in early 1942 demanded Sevastopol's immediate capture, given his obsessions with preserving and expanding his oil supplies and the resistance of iconic enemy cities. After the failures to take Leningrad and Moscow in 1941, Hitler was also adamant that the Wehrmacht should now successfully storm any enemy city that it approached or surrounded. To isolate the garrison by sea, Manstein had only a motley collection of Italian boats and small submarines that were of little aid to some light German craft. If he could not cut off the city's maritime lifelines, he instead relied on air power that at least might hamper convoys to the city and ensure that Russia's Black Sea Fleet could not shell the besiegers. The lack of simultaneous land and sea operations cost the Germans dearly in blood and time. Sevastopol and indeed the entire Black Sea were not critical to the strategic calculus of World War II. The base offered few long-term advantages in advancing Germany's aims in 1942. Given British control of the eastern Mediterranean, there was little chance of supplying the Wehrmacht through the Black Sea, which Hitler had dismissed as merely a frog pond. The Crimean Peninsula itself was a dead end, well off the track of Army Group South's main supply routes from Eastern Europe to the Caucasus. Sevastopol was a relatively small city without much industrial importance. The Soviet defenders had crafted the far better strategy of drawing in and tying down nearly 200,000 Axis troops for over a year. In the fashion of the nonsensical Norway garrisoning, the Germans remained sidetracked. They eroded their strength in Crimean fighting that offered no hope of achieving the favored German goals of either destroying huge Soviet armies by encirclement or securing Germany's oil needs. That said, after nearly a year of Russian resistance, somehow General Manstein's German 11th Army, along with his Romanian and some Italian allies, surrounded Sevastopol and stormed the impregnable fortress in a mere month without much help from the sea. Manstein had two initial advantages. He had first enjoyed easy air superiority. The Luftwaffe's Flieger Corps 8 was in good shape after recovering from its losses of 1941. Stukas and medium bombers in round-the-clock preparatory assaults had within days sunk or damaged most Soviet ships. They destroyed almost all power and water services inside the garrison. Whereas the Germans had adequate rail supplies from their Romanian supply depots, the Russians in the very first 2 weeks of the siege lost the ability to bring in adequate supplies and reinforcements by sea or land. The besieged could only hope that the Luftwaffe itself might run short on fuel and ordnance, or that the Case Blue campaign might eventually force Hitler to transfer planes away from Sevastopol. Manstein also thought he had secret weapons of a sort, huge artillery guns designed to destroy even the thickest Russian concrete bunkers. To complement his arsenal of over 800 Axis artillery pieces, the Germans had the largest artillery batteries in the world, six Gamma mortars, 420 millimeters, three Karl Gerhardt mortars, 600 millimeters, along with the surreal 800 millimeter Gustav cannon that could fire shells in some cases heavier than 7 tons, an explosive payload more than 3 times larger than those carried on the later V-2 guided missiles. The Germans also had 12 large but more quickly firing and less awkward 280-millimeter coastal howitzers and an additional 12 14-inch howitzers. Yet once again, German gigantism, the huge mortars and railguns required thousands of man-hours of labor to assemble the platforms and fire shells, still could not substitute for a messy ground assault. The final victory would eventually cost the Germans over 25,000 casualties and a month's delay for the 11th Army in participating in Case Blue. No accurate records exist of how many Soviet defenders were killed or taken prisoner when the city fell on July 4th. Of the more than 100,000 Russian soldiers garrisoning the stronghold, only a few, mostly officers, escaped. The bastion and indeed the city itself were left in rubble, hit by more than 30,000 tons of artillery shells, the largest German bombardment of the war. The Germans never fully benefited from Sevastopol as either a major supply or naval base. The prolonged absence of Manstein's army from the Case Blue offensive was sorely felt by autumn. Sevastopol played no real role in the later German offensives of 1942 or during the Wehrmacht's retreats of 1943 and 1944. About 2 years after its capture, in May 1944, surrounded German and Romanian forces hastily abandoned Sevastopol by sea and air. One of the most brutal and impressively conducted sieges of World War II resulted in almost no strategic advantage for the victors. Until 1940, Germany had never enjoyed direct access to the Atlantic Ocean. As a result, its wartime strategies in both World War I and II were obsessed with the capture and defense of such major and well-protected harbors on the western coasts of France and Belgium as La Rochelle, Saint-Nazaire, Lorient, Brest, Saint-Malo, Cherbourg, Le Havre, and Antwerp. The notorious 1914 German September Program memo of the philosopher Kurt Rietzler, which had floated possible terms to be imposed on Western Europeans in anticipation that they would lose World War I, had included provisions for German annexation of northern French coastal territory, an apparently ingrained strategic desire of the later German Reich. After the June 1940 defeat of France, Admiral Karl Dönitz began to redeploy most of his U-boat fleet in what would soon be fortified pens at Brest, Lorient, Saint-Nazaire, La Palisse, La Rochelle, and Bordeaux. German submarines were freed from the bottleneck in the North and Baltic seas with easy access to the convoy routes to the Atlantic and Mediterranean. The reinforced concrete U-boat shelters at Lorient were huge, self-contained, and immune from almost any imagined Allied attack. As the later 1944 Allied invasion of Western Europe loomed, Hitler was intent on denying the British and Americans use of these key deepwater ports. As early as March 23, 1942, in fear that the recent entry of the United States into the war might lead to an early Allied landing in France, Hitler had ordered all the key harbors on the Atlantic to serve as the linchpins of a new Atlantic wall. None was ever to be surrendered. Fortified areas and strong points will be defended to the last man. They must never be forced to surrender from lack of ammunition, rations, or water. The Calais area, given its proximity to Great Britain, the most likely focus of any Allied amphibious invasion, was so heavily fortified that early on British planners looked for alternative landing sites, while deluding the Germans into constantly investing even further sums and manpower in its defense. The rationale of the German Atlantic Wall strategy was not necessarily that thousands of fortifications built on the beaches and cliffs would repel invaders at the shore. Rather, if the Allies survived the beaches and moved inland, the French coastal ports were to be turned into self-contained killing traps. Continuing the work of the French before the war, the Germans invested the harbor fortresses with reinforced concrete bunkers, coastal artillery, and underground supply depots, and surrounded them with vast minefields on land and at sea. Their capture would become so costly that the Allies simply would either avoid besieging them, or if they succeeded in taking the harbors, the invaders would find them ruined to the point of being useless. Either way, the Allied expeditionary armies would then die on the vine for want of supplies. For the most part, the Germans were both successful in denying the Allies' use of these harbors and unsuccessful in stopping the Allied advance. In the initial weeks after the D-Day invasion, few ports supplemented the two Allied Mulberry piers. The American-designated Mulberry A was destroyed in a June 19th storm that were towed to Normandy and erected 3 days after the landings in expectation of initial fierce German defense of the French and Belgian ports. Until the November 1944 opening of Antwerp, logistics plagued the Allies and caused a marked slowdown in the British and American advances. Sieges of the Atlantic ports fell into two broad categories, the few harbors that the Allies attempted to storm in 1944, and in every case eventually succeeded in capturing, and the rest that they bypassed, given that taking a likely ruined port was soon discovered not to be worth the effort. Cherbourg, in the Cotentin Peninsula, along with Le Havre, was the largest deepwater harbor nearest the Normandy landings. Invasion planners naturally deemed Cherbourg's docks critical to fuel the post-invasion advance, even after the Americans showed brilliant ad hoc abilities in July to unload up to 15,000 tons per day directly onto Omaha Beach during low tides. The Americans made rapid progress in advancing from the area around Utah Beach to surround Cherbourg. Indeed, the port surrendered on June 29th, just 3 weeks after the D-Day landings. The victory immediately gave some hope that the other Atlantic ports might quickly follow suit. Yet the German Navy commander at Cherbourg, Rear Admiral Walter Hennecke, had so wrecked the harbor infrastructure and docks, an action that earned him the Knight's Cross of the Iron Cross, that the port could not be used to bring in freight until mid-August, and then never in quantities that had been earlier envisioned. General Patton's Third Army activated on August 1, 1944, almost 2 months after the Normandy landings, was originally assigned to capture the Brittany ports to the south and west, especially the key harbor at Brest. Yet after the unexpected Allied breakout during Operation Cobra and the chance of trapping an entire German army group at Falaise, Patton split his forces. Most of the Third Army headed east, while Eighth Corps was assigned the capture of Brest in the opposite direction from Germany. The rapidly advancing Americans thought that they might catch the Germans unawares and grab the more distant Brest within a week, and with it solve much of the growing Allied supply dilemma in a single bold swoop. But General Troy Middleton of Eighth Corps soon discovered that the Germans predictably had already beefed up Brest's natural defenses, stockpiled vast amounts of ammunition, and were busy destroying the harbor facilities. The fighting soon predictably degenerated into house-to-house skirmishing and a siege assault on the inner massive walls of the old city, as each side reverted to the role of medieval besiegers and besieged. More than 6 weeks passed before over 20,000 surviving Germans surrendered Brest on September 19th, but the Allied effort was largely for naught. The port facilities had been blasted into ruin. By the time the harbor was repaired, Brest had already been rendered largely irrelevant by the impending capture of the far larger and more strategically located port at Antwerp to the north, and its growing distance from the advancing American front. It probably would have been far more effective for the Germans to have initially blown up the harbor and then evacuated the garrison so it could join in the defense of Normandy. After the dual debacles at Brest and Cherbourg, the Allies de facto conceded that the nihilistic strategy of the Germans made it hard to justify the costs of frontal assaults. As a result, they began skipping further sieges of many of the coastal ports. Until Antwerp was ready for shipping in November 1944, the Allies continued to bring in supplies at the sole British Mulberry, directly onto the Normandy beaches and, after August, at Marseille, an undeniable dividend of the Operation Dragoon invasion of southern France, but still continued to grow short of supplies. In ironic fashion, the Allies also figured that German strategy could be turned on its head. Thousands of German troops could be bottled up defending port cities at precisely the time when Germany's fading resistance was in desperate need of such manpower. After the messy fighting in Brest, the next key port, La Rochelle, was cut off in early September and blockaded. But otherwise, the diehard garrison was left alone until the German 265th Division surrendered the city at War's End on May 8, 1945. Saint-Nazaire and Lorient followed the same Atlantic pocket strategy of La Rochelle. Both were surrounded by the Allies by mid-August 1944, but never stormed. Saint-Nazaire, in fact, was the last German-held French city to capitulate at the war's end. The strategically important ports at Saint-Malo and Le Havre were belatedly besieged in September 1944. Both were among the most formidable strong points in the Germans' Atlantic Wall, and their defenses had been vastly upgraded to the point of making them nearly invulnerable to the effects of naval gunfire, land artillery, and aerial bombing. Nevertheless, the Allies now tried the tactic of burying the citadels under massive bombardments in hopes that they could avoid the losses incurred at Cherbourg and Brest, and still rebuild the harbor facilities out of the rubble. The first hope came to fruition, the second did not. Saint-Malo was attacked in early August 1944 and immediately proved unassailable, prompting a horrendous incendiary bombing that ruined the city. When the Americans entered the harbor on August 17th, the historic old port was little more than rubble. Le Havre was likewise literally reduced to ruins. Its surviving garrison of 12,000 Germans was captured in just 3 days after the final assault, September 10th through the 12th. Although the British losses were light, the port was left in shambles and of little value in supplying the last 10 months of the war effort. General Montgomery considered the northernmost French Channel ports at Boulogne, Calais, and Dunkirk critical to supply the advance of the British Army and far easier to besiege. Yet in the end, they too mostly followed the prior frustrating paradox of either being bypassed until the war's end, Dunkirk, September 15, 1944 through May 9, 1945, or subjected to so much firepower as to be rendered useless. Even those few ports that were captured in September 1944 and taken with only moderate losses, for example, Boulogne, September 17 through the 22nd, and Calais, September 22nd through August 1st, brought little advantage to the Allies given the wreckage of their harbors. Much of the Allied confusion over whether to storm or bypass the French ports resulted from the uncertain status of Antwerp, less than 200 miles as the crow flies from central London. Along with Rotterdam, not liberated until May 5, 1945, it had traditionally served as one of the two great European harbors on the Atlantic. At first, it seemed that with the capture of both Antwerp proper and Brussels in August 1944, the Allies now had less need for the French ports. Antwerp was intact. Its huge size and proximity to the industrially rich German Ruhr, little over 120 miles distant, offered hopes that the Allies might still reach Germany before winter 1944. But General Montgomery had failed to secure the Scheldt estuaries in early September, and without control of these long approaches to the harbor, ships could not in safety reach the otherwise secure docks at Antwerp. A costly and tragically unnecessary battle then ensued from October 2nd to November 8th to free up the estuaries and gain unfettered access to the Belgian port. Only after November 12th were the majority of Allied supplies able to pass through Antwerp, largely due to the heroism of the Canadian attackers. With a full use of Antwerp and the invaluable harbor at Marseille on the Mediterranean, the once pressing need either to storm French harbors to the south or to ensure the rapid repair of those already in Allied hands mostly passed. All the German coastal garrisons, at one point encompassing over 400,000 troops, were trapped. And all would eventually surrender. But key questions were never answered about the wisdom of besieging them, how quickly, at what cost, and to whose profit. The Allied besiegers, in efforts to gain the ports without massive losses, were faced with dilemmas, whether immediately and at great risk to assault the harbor fortresses, or to bomb them first into rubble, or to blockade these strong points and bypass them altogether. The proper answer hinged on intangibles, and again was never properly addressed, explaining why the single surviving artificial Mulberry Harbor remained in service for 8 months until early 1945. If the harbors were rendered useless to the Allies, their garrisons were in turn rendered useless to the eventual defense of the German homeland. General Rundstedt was on record that he thought Hitler's stand-and-die orders doomed tens of thousands of German soldiers in the ports who otherwise might have offered key manpower in defense of the Reich. We subsequently lost 120,000 in these concrete posts. When we withdrew from France, I always considered this to be a tragic waste of useful manpower. As for the Atlantic Wall, it had to be seen to be believed. It had no depth and little surface. It was sheer humbug. According to the wartime Berlin diaries of the White Russian aristocrat Marie Vasilchikov, the sham fortifications apparently had been sold to the German public as a viable obstacle to the Allies. On June 6, 1944, she noted, "The long-awaited D-Day, the Allies have landed in Normandy. We had been told so much about the famous Atlantic Wall and its supposedly impregnable defenses. Now we shall see." Island citadels often required the attacker to undertake amphibious operations or to build a land bridge from the mainland, as Alexander the Great had done to capture the island city of Tyre, 332 BC. Yet the fate of these fortresses usually hinged not so much on the nature of the fortifications and the size of the garrison, as on the relative strategic situation at the time and the nature of the defenders. Trapped, Axis and Russian forces rarely ever gave up. British and Americans often did. The degree of naval and air superiority in the vicinity made resupply either reliable or impossible, and so the redoubt became either a fortress or a tomb. Tiny Malta, just 100 square miles in size, with 250,000 people in 1940, should never have survived, just as it should never have withstood the overwhelming forces of the Ottoman Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent that failed to capture the Christian stronghold in 1565. On June 10, 1940, modern Malta was first attacked by Mussolini's air forces not long after Italy opportunistically declared war on the Allies. Over 3,000 Italian and German bombing missions were to follow against what Il Duce called Malta Nostra. Within a year, a bombed-out Malta was reduced to a lonely, isolated Allied island in an Axis lake. The northern Mediterranean coast, Spain, France, Italy, Yugoslavia, Greece, and Turkey, was either in Axis hands or nominally neutral but pro-German. In mid-1942, Rommel was forcing the British out of Libya and back to Egypt. The African shoreline was still mostly either in German or Italian hands, or left to the collaborationist Vichy French. The other historical stepping stones of invasion from Europe to Africa and vice versa, Crete and Sicily, were likewise Axis-held. So were Corsica and Sardinia. After the collapse of France in June 1940 and the extinction of the French Mediterranean fleet, Malta was without secure sea lanes. In terms of relative size, the Italian fleet now outnumbered vulnerable British Mediterranean naval forces that lacked air superiority any time they dared to steam between Gibraltar and Alexandria. Even before the French collapse, the British and French had pondered abandoning Malta altogether. Britain already had lost almost all hope, given that Malta's air force of three obsolete biplane Gloster Gladiators, dubbed Faith, Hope, and Charity, provided no deterrent. Almost every major event of the Mediterranean War between 1940 and 1942, the loss of the French fleet, the control of Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia by Vichy France, the entrance of Italy into the war, the Axis invasions of North Africa, the establishment of enemy bases in Sicily and Crete, the appearance of German U-boats in the Mediterranean, made things seem even more hopeless for Malta. The island's formidable ramparts had always required an invader to obtain regional naval supremacy and to have adequate supplies to ensure an amphibious landing, blockade, and occupation. That was difficult in any age, as the Ottomans in 1565 had learned after their failed efforts against the outnumbered defenses of the Knights Hospitaller. Even modern air and naval power did not really change that age-old calculus. While the Germans and Italians nearly destroyed the air forces of Malta, regular British aircraft resupply by carriers ensured that the Luftwaffe never quite achieved aerial supremacy. The Axis never landed any troops on the island. For all his braggadocio, Mussolini had no serious plans of invasion after his dramatic declaration of war. There were two air sieges of Malta. The first was Italian-led, framed around Mussolini's efforts in 1940 to secure Libya. Despite the initial inability of the British to supply the island with modern warplanes or to base capital ships safely at Valletta, the Italians failed utterly in all their half-hearted efforts between June and December 1940. Their naval, air, and land forces lacked sufficient fuel, supplies, and expertise systematically to bomb the city into submission, defeat the British fleet, or land forces on the island. The Italian Navy had neither independent air capability nor expertise at night operations. Despite some heroic efforts, it would not win any of its three early major encounters with the British fleet at Taranto, Calabria, and Cape Matapan. As long as British-held Gibraltar and Suez governed both the entry and exit of the Mediterranean Sea, it was nearly impossible for either Germany or Japan to send sizable forces to join the Italian war effort in the Mediterranean. Malta's brief reprieve from Mussolini mostly ended in February 1941, when Erwin Rommel started operations in Libya with his Afrika Corps to save the stalled Italians. German bases in Sicily, just 90 miles from Malta, and by June 1942 in Tripoli, 220 miles distant, meant that succor for Malta from the west was nearly cut off, while German-held Crete interdicted aid from the endangered British in Egypt. Malta was saved by unforeseen events. The successful airborne conquest of Crete, May 20th through June 1st, 1941, proved so costly, nearly 7,000 German casualties, that Hitler was reluctant ever again to stage a Mediterranean parachute assault. Nonetheless, it seemed inexplicable that the Führer, who by the end of 1941 had sent hundreds of thousands to their deaths in a foolhardy invasion of Russia, would not dare to risk a fraction of such forces in a much more likely victory at Malta, which had far fewer defenders, was far smaller than Crete, and was far more strategically important in terms of transporting supplies southward by rail from northern Europe and on by ship to North Africa. The Germans lacked not only aircraft carriers, but also any major surface ships in the Mediterranean, and were not eager to send U-boats near Gibraltar. After the Allied invasion of Sicily, July 1943, and even before the Operation Dragoon landings in southern France, August 1944, U-boat activity sputtered and then ceased almost entirely. While nearly 500,000 tons of Allied merchant shipping were lost to U-boats in the Mediterranean, including 24 Royal Navy ships, Allied east-west sea lanes in the Mediterranean between Alexandria and Gibraltar were never completely cut off, even though they were far longer and more tenuous than the north-south axis traffic between southern Europe and North Africa. Finally, the arrival of the new U.S. ally meant that Allied naval and amphibious forces would be in North Africa by November 2, 1942, just 11 months after both Germany and Italy had declared war on America. Growing Allied power would finally end Malta's isolation and eventually doom U-boat operations and the occasional breakout of the Italian fleet. The U.S. carrier Wasp had already helped bring additional Spitfire fighter aircraft to Malta on two occasions in spring 1942. One of the reasons why the Axis failed in North Africa was their control of only two, Crete and Sicily, of the five modern Mediterranean choke points, the remaining being the more strategically positioned Gibraltar, Malta, and Suez, that were critical for supply between Europe and North Africa. Had Hitler taken Gibraltar, Malta would have been doomed. Malta-based ships and planes eventually took a heavy toll on Axis convoys. As the war changed with the entry of the Soviet Union and then the United States into the conflict, the logistics of the Mediterranean also radically shifted. By late 1942, over a quarter of all Axis supplies to North Africa were being destroyed by Malta-based planes and ships. In the fighting over and around Malta, over 500 Axis planes were lost. More than 2,000 Axis merchant ships were sunk, and over 17,000 sailors and airmen were killed. The British also paid a high price to keep and strengthen Malta. Two carriers, one battleship, two cruisers, 19 destroyers, and almost 40 submarines. Controversy still exists over whether it was Malta-based forces or the coming of the Americans and the huge Allied fleet in November 1942, or the continued German drain on the Eastern Front that explained the disintegration of Axis supply lines. But without Malta, the Allies would have had little reliable air deterrent in the central Mediterranean. The Axis generals were right that the survival of Malta helped finish their efforts in North Africa. The bombed-out ruins of Malta were once again more proof that in the landscape of 20th-century siegecraft, air power could level a city without guaranteeing either its capture or extinction. Singapore, the British island bastion at the tip of the Malay Peninsula, was often dubbed the Gibraltar of the Pacific, but it was hardly that, either in terms of strategic importance or impregnability. Although the base was praised as a showcase British port fortress, and likewise autonomous from the surrounding Malaysian mainland, Singapore was no strategic choke point. To enter the Mediterranean from the west, every ship had to pass within about 8 miles of Gibraltar's defenses. In contrast, there were ways of navigating between the Australian and Asian continents and the Pacific and Indian Oceans without entering the straits near Singapore. After the Japanese capture, the Allies simply bypassed the fortress for the entire duration of the war, apparently finding the Japanese bases there no obstacle to dismantling the Japanese overseas empire. As was the case with many pre-World War II island fortresses, Singapore reflected the age of the battleship. Its five huge 15-inch naval guns, armed with large stocks of armor-piercing shells to be aimed at incoming capital ships, were designed to face seaward into an increasingly empty ocean. The huge batteries could bar the approach of battleships like the Yamato or Musashi that never came. But they could not so easily stop a more likely landward attack from the mainland or naval air attacks from distant carriers or fighters based in Southeast Asia. Its fighter forces, like those at Malta, were both out of date and too few. Depression-era Britain had apparently determined that it could only protect its home waters and have a respectable presence in the Mediterranean if it mostly shorted its Pacific bases and Singapore in particular. All that said, Singapore need not have fallen, at least not as quickly as it did in February 1942. Initially, it was resupplied with some relatively modern Hawker Hurricane fighter planes by British carrier forces. The overall commander of the fortress's defenses, Lieutenant General Arthur Percival, a decorated veteran of World War I with notable interwar service, had at least 100,000 Dominion defenders, almost a third of them British and Australians. In contrast, Japanese General Tomoyuki Yamashita, who would be executed by Allied courts for war crimes after the war, headed down the Malay Peninsula with only 35,000 Japanese attackers, slogging the arduous 650-mile trek from Thailand at the rate of 10 miles per day. By the time they neared the island fortress, they had been worn out by the jungle and harassing attacks. Yamashita's forces approached the city with only a fourth of the numbers of the defenders, who were still relatively battle-ready. In the history of siegecraft, such numerically inferior attackers almost never successfully stormed a fortress city. Those who tried, from the Athenians at Syracuse to the Germans at Moscow, usually met with disaster. Yet Yamashita prevailed. Morale explains much of his success. For most of December 1941 and February 1942, Yamashita insidiously beat British forces back to Singapore, a bewildering experience for the once confident Dominion troops who had come to fear the jungle and had bizarrely assumed that the largely urban Japanese were better equipped as Asians to navigate through it. The appearance of Japanese air forces, especially Mitsubishi fighters and two-engine bombers, added to British insecurities. The Japanese pilots usually bested the dwindling number of British Hawker Hurricanes that had been flown in as reinforcements more than 2 years after these planes had played such a prominent role in saving Britain from the German Luftwaffe. In short order and despite heroics, the fortress's obsolete original fleet of Swordfish and Wildebeest bombers and Brewster Buffalo fighters all proved veritable flying coffins. The British were stunned that they had already matched the supposedly indomitable Luftwaffe, and yet with 2 additional years of experience were ill-prepared for the supposedly less sophisticated Japanese. Inexplicably, on the eve of the outbreak of the Pacific War, the British, who had staged a brilliant naval air assault on Italian battleships at Taranto over a year earlier, and had just sunk the Bismarck in late May 1941, in part due to carrier aircraft slowing down the German battleship's escape, had sent to Singapore 2 frontline ships, Force Z, without air cover. The almost new battleship HMS Prince of Wales and the old but still powerful battlecruiser HMS Repulse, along with 4 destroyers, might have proved formidable with 14 and 15-inch batteries against Japanese capital ships in a classical engagement like the Battle of Jutland. Yet 3 days after Pearl Harbor, both ships were blasted apart about 100 miles north of Singapore by at least 82 Indochinese-based Japanese torpedo and dive bombers, a horror that led to subsequent British despair in holding the base itself. Much of Singapore's defenses rested on fantasies that the British were innately superior to the Japanese and that their ships and planes were better built and manned. In fact, just the opposite was true, given superb first-generation Zero pilots and the fact that by February 1942, Japan had the largest aircraft carrier fleet in the world. The British, who had invented the aircraft carrier in 1912, had forgotten their own axiom that battleships without air cover were negligible assets. It proved tragic irony that Admiral Sir Tom Phillips, one of the few British high officers who had not appreciated the vulnerability of capital ships to air power, was killed by Japanese bombers and torpedo planes. Singapore was quickly exposed as a sad paradox, a huge naval base without a single major warship. Japanese soldiers suddenly went from backward Asiatics to Pacific supermen. Lieutenant General Percival came to believe that his forces simply could not stop the advance of the implacable Japanese on land, in the air, or by sea, and that there was not much point in fighting further once he ran out of space to retreat. In truth, by the time Yamashita had isolated the island of Singapore from the mainland and crossed over on February 8th, his army was nearly exhausted by the jungle and sick. Yet once the Japanese easily made their way over the narrow channel and landed on the island city-state, it took only a week to force a British collapse. When Percival surrendered, British-led forces had suffered only 5,000 killed or wounded in the defense of the island. Over 100,000 soldiers of various sorts were still able-bodied, equipped with over 700 artillery pieces and field guns. A distant and disheartened Winston Churchill found all this disgraceful. Although he had unwisely allowed Force Z to proceed to Singapore without the aircraft carrier HMS Illustrious, disabled in the Caribbean, and foolishly sought to defend Singapore by sending only piecemeal reinforcements, he nevertheless later wrote that the loss of his favorite ships depressed him as few other events of the war. "In the war, I never received a more direct shock. As I turned over and twisted in bed, the full horror of the news sank in upon me." Churchill famously remarked of the surrender that it was "the worst disaster and largest capitulation in British history." In truth, it was not quite the worst British military catastrophe. Here one can think of a long litany such as Yorktown, New Orleans, Passchendaele, Gallipoli, the Somme, or Dunkirk, but rather the most humiliating surrender. Apparently, Churchill had reckoned that the British at Singapore might fight like the heroic besieged in Russia where, for example at Leningrad, over 20 times more Russian civilians and soldiers would die in saving their city than those at Singapore did in losing it. In Percival's defense, Singapore was a colonial metropolis that had grown with refugees to at least 500,000 residents and whose food and water supplies were finite. He apparently believed that continued resistance was not only futile, but threatened the survival of thousands of civilians. If not Yamashita's force today, a greater Japanese expeditionary force would arrive in the near future, given that the chances of a British or American rescue fleet on the horizon were nil. The British might not have surrendered so readily had they been suspicious of the far worse specter of Japanese savagery to follow for both civilians and their own prisoners. Well over 50,000 Chinese were subsequently executed by the secret police of the victorious Japanese, especially during the infamous Sukching massacres. Few Europeans or Americans this early in the war quite fathomed that their own capitulation to the Japanese ensured the slaughter of thousands of Asians who were condemned by their friendship to the enemies of the so-called Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere. Percival, pale, thin, buck-toothed, non-photogenic, may have been easily caricatured after his ignominious surrender as a deer-in-the-headlights fossil, but there was also truth to his image as a British colonial apparatchik with no clue of the ferocity or modern resources of his enemy, and bewildered that his race and nationality no longer conferred any inherent deference. He seemed to have thought that relative power in the East had ossified around 1920 and had no clue of what the Japanese had achieved in air power and naval power 20 years later. As for the siege itself, Percival had not in any serious fashion fortified the island's coastline. He had misjudged the location of the main thrust of the enemy attack, stubbornly convinced the Japanese would land on Singapore's northeastern shore. Nor did he have much idea of the symbolic importance of Singapore's survival in steadying British forces in the Pacific during the dark days of early 1942. To be fair to Percival, it is also difficult to imagine a British-held Singapore surviving much longer than did Corregidor. If the American stronghold in the Philippines was more isolated, it was also a more defensible fortress and characterized by better leadership, higher troop morale, and far more effective integration of native troops. Yet it also fell just 3 months later. Britain's Singapore strategy of predicating forward British Pacific defense on the Great Naval Base was inherently flawed given the paucity of the actual forces at its disposal. Preliminary pre-war discussions between the Americans and the British concerning forward basing some U.S. ships at Singapore failed due to mutual suspicions and shared ill-preparedness. But even had Singapore hosted a greater Allied surface fleet, the idea that one or two British and American carriers would have defeated the finest and largest carrier fleet in the world in the first days of World War II in the Pacific was unlikely. At the time of Singapore's fall, there were only 4 major active Allied capital ships, 3 American carriers and 1 battleship, operating in the Eastern Pacific. By late 1942, only 1 surviving American carrier was left operational. All available Allied fighters were mostly inferior in number and quality to the Japanese. Tactical blunders and strategic obtuseness had doomed Singapore. Yet there was truth to Percival's complaint when a prisoner of the Japanese, "I lost because I never had a chance." Singapore could have been saved for a while in 1942, but it is hard to see how it could have survived for long given the dominance of the Imperial Japanese Navy. Ironically, for the duration of the war, the Japanese found little strategic advantage in holding Singapore other than its propaganda value. There were closer bases for staging operations against India and Burma, and far better ones for defending Japan. Other than serving as an Axis submarine base and its chief strategic importance as a depot for invaluable Malayan tin and rubber, then 60% of the world's supply, Singapore proved a Japanese Norway, tying down thousands of occupation troops in an increasing backwater of the war. The advancing Americans and British in 1944 and 1945 bypassed it altogether to focus on islands closer to the Japanese mainland. Singapore, in the manner of the French Atlantic ports, did not surrender until September 1945. The British found it much as they had left it in February 1942, albeit without tens of thousands of civilians who had been executed during the brutal Japanese occupation. In contrast to Singapore, the Philippines were closer to both China and Japan. Manila was just 700 miles from Hong Kong and 1,900 miles distant from Tokyo itself. The islands were key to the Japanese naval supply routes of its envisioned new Pacific Empire. For the Japanese in early 1942, capturing a huge American base was strategically